Hello, folks. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sun Sounds, and I have Time Magazine for you today. And this is the first week of our biweekly issue, so I'll be reading you the feature stories. And we have three. The first one is the Harris Plan. The second one is a general elected in Indonesia. And the third one, a new generation of leaders. So let's start right out with the Harris Plan. What Kind of President Will She Be? By Charlotte Alter in Pittsburgh. On a sunny Wednesday in late September, Vice President Kamala Harris took the stage at Carnegie Mellon University for the first comprehensive economic policy speech of her short presidential campaign. Addressing a sedate audience in suits and ties, the Vice President outlined plans to strengthen small businesses, cut taxes on the middle class, and build more affordable housing. "I am a capitalist," she told the Pittsburgh crowd, detailing how she would invest in startups and increase public-private partnerships, and describing an approach to economic growth that stressed stability. It was a business-friendly speech, tailored to business-friendly voters. But in a neck-and-neck presidential race, wonky pitches like these could make the difference. In a September New York Times Siena poll, nearly 30% of likely voters said they felt that they needed to learn more about the vice president before making their choice. The fight to define Kamala Harris, who she is, what she stands for, and what kind of president she will be one of the central battles of the campaign's final weeks. To examine these questions, Time spoke with 20 current and former Harris campaign advisors, former aides in her vice presidential and Senate offices, senior officials from each of the past five presidential administrations, and a range of policy experts. The portrait that emerged was of a politician who is more practical than ideological, a cautious candidate running in a change election, juggling the liabilities and benefits of her ties to her boss, that President Joe Biden, as well as her own past positions, all while trying to keep the focus on her opponent. For Harris, policy specifics are in service to the larger goal of her campaign, which is to present a credible alternative to a second Donald Trump presidency. At Carnegie Mellon, Harris offered the most detailed look at her economic plans since taking over as the Democratic nominee. She is proposing a $50,000 tax deduction to help Americans start more small businesses and a $6,000 child tax credit for families in the first year of a baby's life. She plans to expend $35 insulin to all Americans and eliminate degree requirements for 500,000 federal jobs. She wants to invest in research and development in new manufacturing industries and trim red tape to further the Biden administration's overhaul of America's infrastructure. Perhaps more than any other presidential candidate in recent memory, Harris has focused on solving America's housing crisis. She plans to offer $25,000 in down payment assistance to first-time homebuyers, tax credit to incentivize builders, and pledges to build 3 million affordable housing units in her first term. You can imagine the Harris presidency as a iOS upgrade of the current administration. The operating system would stay the same, but with new features and better packaging. There are tonal differences between the two. Harris talks more, and more comfortably, about abortion rights than Biden ever did, speaks with more empathy about the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza, and has put housing and small business at the center of her plans for strengthening the middle class. But for the most part, allies and critics agree there is little evident policy daylight between the Democratic nominee and the president that she replaced atop the party's ticket this summer. The sharper contrast is between Harris's current position and her previous ones. If you talk to Harris's advisors, the word that frequently comes up is pragmatic. But the candidate who campaigned for president in the 2020 Democratic primary was part of the party's leftward lurch. Back then, Harris supported a public health care option and a Green New Deal. She wanted to ban fracking, decriminalize unauthorized border crossings, and cut funding for immigrant detention. She backed forcing owners of assault weapons to sell them to the government. She has since changed her stance on all of these issues. Some voters see these shifts as part of a predictable pivot to the center. Others see them as flip-flops in need of an explanation. Outside the auditorium at Carnegie Mellon, Rodrigo Lopez, a registered independent from Florida, was finishing up homework for his mechanical engineering class. Lopez followed the 2020 primary closely and recalled that Harris took left-wing positions he disliked. He said he would never vote for Trump, but doesn't feel that he knows enough about Harris to cast a ballot for her either. It's hard to tell what her real policy intentions are, he says. Harris could win my vote, Lopez adds, if she articulates the reasons that she's changed some of her stances. Harris is hardly the first presidential candidate to change her positions. Trump has flipped on everything, from abortion to gun control to Social Security. When asked on 60 Minutes about her shifts since 2020, she said that her time as vice president has included a lot of listening and consensus building. Forging compromise is not a bad thing, she said, as long as you don't compromise your values. What she means, according to her aides, is that her goals remain the same: affordable health care, a strong middle class, but she is flexible about how to achieve them. Yet she has skirted the thorough accounting of her policy evolution that Lopez is seeking, in part by speaking infrequently to reporters. When she does do interviews, she mostly favors local media, culture podcasts, and friendly talk shows. Harris declined repeated requests for an interview for this story. Although she appeared on 60 Minutes and was interviewed by Bill Barr on Fox News. In contrast, Trump talked about his policy vision with a charm reporter for 90 minutes across two interviews, although he refused to appear on 60 Minutes. Biden spoke to Time at similar length before dropping out of the race. Harris is running on what she won't do as much as what she would. She won't curb abortion rights, as Republicans want to do. She won't impose Trump's blanket tariffs, which most economists believe would raise prices and could throw the country into a recession. Hers are more narrowly targeted. She won't initiate the mass deportation of undocumented immigrants, as Trump promises, or fire legions of civil servants and replace them with MAGA loyalists. She won't attempt to overturn the results of a free and fair election, as Trump did. Once upon a time, presidential candidates compared healthcare plans or tax policies when competing for votes. These days, a policy-heavy campaign can weigh you down. Elizabeth Warren's "I Have a Plan for That" campaign sputtered through the 2020 primary, failing to win a single state. She lost the nomination to Biden, whose campaign was about restoring the soul of the nation, whatever that was. Airy promises of hope and change worked for Barack Obama, whereas Hillary Clinton's economic white papers did not. Trump's own campaign is constructed around a set of one-liners. He acknowledged in his recent debate with Harris that he had only a concept of a plan for overhauling the American healthcare system. None of that has cost him an iota of support. Instead of policy, many voters are making their decisions based on tribal allegiance or vibes, which is one reason that Harris's approach may be a winning strategy. For many, the fact that she is not Trump is reason enough to vote for her. Running against MAGA has boosted Democrats to victory in scores of elections since 2016, whether those candidates had well-defined policies or not. She knows that very few people are going to choose between her and Donald Trump based on some details of economic strategy or some full-fledged proposal, so she's not presenting them, says David Wessel, director of fiscal and monetary policy at the Brookings Institute, a nonpartisan think tank. It's a strategy to win the election. What reason is there to put out a detailed economic plan if your opponent is just throwing snowballs? When someone joins the vice president's staff, Harris often asks them to think of a wedding album. Imagine that you've been to someone's wedding, she says, and you go to their home to see their photo album. When you start flipping through it, what are you looking for? The question is rhetorical. You're looking for yourself because you want to see if you're in their vision of what their day was, recalls Rohini Kosigo, Harris's former domestic policy advisor. That's how the American people feel when they're listening to us talk. Are they in our vision when we see the future of our country? This approach, more than any ideology or economic theory, animates Harris's style on governance. How does policy feel to the people who are experiencing it? One aide recalls a conversation about transportation infrastructure in which the vice president asked how the outcome would work for a mother pushing her stroller down the street. Another ally recalls how, after hearing small housing owner tick off the burdens of paperwork, Harris worked to automate the way that small businesses pay taxes. When discussing abortion restrictions, she often describes how painful it must be for a patient to wait in line at TSA while flying out of state to get reproductive care. She puts a tremendous amount of capital on having people make sure that they're really thought through the everyday life and experience of America, says Kosigi. Harris has put abortion at the center of her campaign with a promise to suspend the filibuster to restore the protections of Roe v. Wade. She would extend Biden's initiatives on infrastructure, climate, and jobs, while adding new ones to build more affordable housing, invest in small businesses, and cut taxes on working families. On October 8th, she proposed a new Medicare benefit to help families pay for home health aides for seniors and the disabled. To finance all this, she proposes increasing the long-term capital gains on people who make more than $1 million a year and restoring the 28% corporate tax rate that existed under previous Democratic and Republican presidents. Biden's domestic agenda was partly a product of the crises that he inherited, rebuilding from the pandemic, revitalizing America's manufacturing sector. Harris, who had a front row seat as voters struggle with inflation, created political headaches for the administration, promises to curb high prices on everything from groceries to health care. The goal is to lower your costs by cutting your taxes, to lower housing costs, to lower pharmaceutical costs, says Brian Deese, who served as director of the National Economic Council under Biden and is now one of Harris's top economic advisors. Opponents tell a different story. Harris's agenda is the Biden administration agenda light, says Douglas Holtz Eakin, president of the American Action Forum in a center-right think tank in Washington, and the former senior economic advisor for Republican John McCain's 2008 campaign. Holtz Eakin considers Harris's plans to be profoundly anti-growth because of their reliance on government programs. Yet he thinks that Trump's proposed tariffs would be equally bad. Neither are good for the economy, he says. By many means, the economy has thrived under the Biden-Harris administration, with 16 million new jobs created, unemployment hovering around 4%, and manufacturing jobs at a 10-year high, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. GDP growth is around 3% this year, and the stock market keeps hitting all-time highs. But even if the data is good, the economic vibes are bad. Housing costs in particular have skyrocketed over the past decade, which is why Harris has put housing affordability at the heart of her economic agenda. In addition to that proposal for first-time homebuyers, which could be whittled down to face a divided Congress, she's proposing significant expansion on the low-income housing tax credit, a popular and long-standing bipartisan initiative that incentivizes developers to build more affordable rentals. She's also proposing a tax cut designed to encourage more homes to be built for first-time homebuyers and a $40 billion innovation fund. Housing experts say no other presidential candidate in recent memory has proposed such a detailed plan. For years, housing affordability was a silent crisis, says Dennis Shea, who leads the housing program at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Now it's a front burner issue. Harris has also proposed several ways to ease burdens on small businesses, which provide nearly half of American jobs. Helping small businesses was part of her White House portfolio, and even conservative critics acknowledge that she's been attentive to the issue. In addition to offering a $50,000 tax deduction to help new small businesses offset startup costs, she proposes to ease permitting and automate processes, with a goal of 25 million new startup applications in her first term. If you ask small businesses that what they don't like, they will always say it's really hard to get permits and hard to get licensing. This paperwork has gotten to be too much, says Karen Mills, who ran the Small Business Administration under President Obama. It's the first time I've heard someone listen to that. Some economists are skeptical of Harris's tax proposals. In the aggregate, all these provisions would have a negative impact on economic growth, says Alex Durante, an economist at the Tax Foundation, a center-right research institute. But even many conservatives doubt that Trump would be much better for the economy, citing his tariffs and immigration plans. Goldman Sachs announced in September that they estimate a stronger economy and more job growth under a Harris presidency than a second Trump term. Modeling by the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania forecasts that Trump's plans could increase the deficit five times as much as Harris's would. Taken together, Harris's economic plans are good for lower and middle-income Americans and small businesses and tough on high-net-worth households and corporations, says Mark Zandi, chief economist at Moody's, who has predicted Harris's victory. Her proposals are not going to change the growth rates of the economy in a meaningful way, Zandi adds, but it does change who benefits the most from that, and that's going to be low and middle income households. Biden's successor will have to grapple with multiple foreign policy crises now gripping the White House. The next commander-in-chief will have to deal with wars in Europe and the Middle East and compete with China. Harris has deliberately not staked out new foreign policy positions, aides say, since she's still the current vice president. Still, there are subtle but important differences between their approaches. While Biden views the world as a contest between democracy and authoritarianism, Harris is a former prosecutor and sees it through the prism of rules and norms, a fight between those who uphold the rules-based order and those who undermine it. As a Californian who once represented Silicon Valley, she sees technology as a crucial part of America's global leadership and would put it at the center of her foreign policy. She also tends to talk more about the global South than Biden does. One of Harris's first diplomatic assignments was to stem the flow of immigrants arriving in the U.S. by addressing the economic and security conditions in the Northern Triangle countries of Central America, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras. In an effort to improve life in the region, Harris helped launch a public and private partnership that drove big companies to invest more than $5 billion there. Such long-term economic strategies haven't succeeded in the past, and illegal crossings still spiked under Biden. Harris, like her boss, has recently toughened her position on border security. She now talks about her experience as the Attorney General of a border state, prosecuting transnational cartels and drug smugglers. She supported the bipartisan immigration bill that would have hired 1,500 new Border Patrol agents, improved the asylum process, and paid for new fentanyl inspection machines. Though she is a daughter of immigrants, Harris is not as sympathetic to some of the immigration advocacies, says Doris Messner, a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute, a nonpartisan think tank. She's sympathetic to immigrants, but since she's always going to be strong on the fact that there needs to be control and discipline and consistency in the way that we do it. On the spreading war in the Middle East, Harris has condemned the atrocities committed by Hamas on October 7th, promoted Israel's right to defend itself, and called for a ceasefire with a return of the hostages. Some supporters glean signs of greater sympathy for civilians in Gaza, even if the distinctions are subtle and rhetorical. What I sense from her is that she is willing to be less accommodating of Israel even than Biden was, says Michael Allen, who served on the President George W. Bush's National Security Council. She's more progressive than Biden, so I think she'd be more inclined to the point of view that the Israelis, especially Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, have prosecuted the war too aggressively. And Harris aide says in a statement that she has a lifelong and unwavering commitment to the security of Israel, and added that she shares Biden's larger goals of de-escalation, a hostage deal, and a ceasefire. Harris has not given an address focused solely on foreign policy, and she is viewed mostly as a supporting character in the Biden administration's overseas dramas. I don't think anybody with a straight face could really say that she considered a foreign policy powerhouse, says Elbridge Colby, a national security expert who served in the Trump Pentagon and argues for a tougher approach on China. Her closest foreign policy advisor, Philip Gordon, has served Democratic presidents since Bill Clinton, and he and his aides are more likely to stay the course than seek to remake American strategy. A Harris presidency, says Colby, would mean a generation younger, more progressive version of the current foreign policy. To Republicans' dismay, Harris's careful policy rollout appears to be working. When she entered the race, Trump had a decisive lead on many of the issues that voters say they consider most important: immigration, the economy, the cost of living. Polls show Harris beginning to erase this edge. Harris is virtually tied with Trump on who voters trust to handle the economy, and only narrowly trails him on immigration, according to a September AP poll. She continues to lead by broad margins on health care, abortion, and climate change. Two recent polls found that more Americans see Harris as the candidate representing change. Whether it's change from Biden or change from Trump, Harris supporters have seized that mantle. The chant at her rallies is, "We're not going back." Still, 65% of registered voters say that the country is on the wrong track, which is a tough number for the party in power. That sour mood represents Harris with a delicate challenge, boasting about the Biden administration accomplishments on infrastructure, insulin, and green jobs, while distancing herself from both her predecessor and her old policy platform. She has a record of saying things that she's now trying to pivot from, says Ted Geyer, president of Deniskanen Center, a nonpartisan think tank. "I can look at that, and it can cause suspicion, or I can look at that and be happy for the pivot. I'm happy for the pivot." Aides argue that her current platform is rooted in political reality. "She is guided by pragmatism, not ideology," says Deese, a top economic advisor. "That doesn't mean we can't set big goals, but it means we need to be highly practical and constantly ask ourselves the question, is this working? And if it's not, try something else." As Harris left her economic policy speech at Carnegie Mellon, students lined up along the street, waiting silently for her motorcade. As the line of black cars passed the crowd, Harris appeared in the window, waving through the glass, her face framed by the window like a living postage stamp. The crowd began to cheer, and the girl standing next to me began to cry. Her name was Naomi Barba, an 18-year-old with long, curly hair. I asked Barba, was there a particular policy proposal of Harris's that excited her? "Honestly, not that much," she said. "She's bringing a lot of hope and optimism. I know what I don't like about Donald Trump." Folks, you're listening to Sun Sounds, and we're going to continue now with the second feature story from this week's Time magazine, and the title of this one is The Chosen One. Elected president with more votes than anyone else in history, Prabowo Subianto aims to keep Indonesia on a tightrope between world powers, and this is by Charlie Campbell. A dozen masked commandos crouch inside a jet-black dinghy as it carves across shimmering Jakarta Bay. At the bow, loops of 12.7-millimeter bullets spill from a tri-barreled Gatling gun at the stern. Prabowo Subianto, Indonesia's defense minister and president-elect, appraises the fishing boats and rusting refueling stations that pepper the inky water. As the dinghy docks at the Muara Angke, a slum perched on the northern shore of Indonesia's sprawling capital, the 72-year-old Prabowo clambs onto the land and plunges into a cheering crowd, shaking hands and kissing babies. In his wake, aides pass out plastic trinkets from trash bags to barefoot kids. Feels like a campaign stop, but Prabowo isn't campaigning. He already won Indonesia's highest office with over 58% of the vote in February elections and will be inaugurated on October 20th. That landslide saw over 96 million votes cast for the former general, the most ever for a single candidate anywhere in recorded history. It was 2 weeks before polling day that Prabowo last stopped by Morara Angi, only to be heartbroken, he says, by its pauperized inhabitants wallowing waist-deep in floodwater filled with human excrement and discarded mussel shells. Harvesting the seafood is the main local industry. Prabowo immediately ordered the National Defense University to construct 200 new, low-cost floating and stilted houses fitted with solar panels, indoor bathrooms, and filtered drinking water. This return trip in August was simply to kick the tires and inspect whether all was ship-shape, though the deafening three-syllable chants of Prabowo telegraphed the local reaction even before he had stepped onto the dock. "It's heartwarming," Prabowo tells Time of his reception in his first Western media interview since his election victory. "But it's also sad, the way these people lived, and there's still so much work to do." In Prabowo's success, dragging Morara Angi out of the mire is impressive. He faces a stiffer challenge to uplift all of Indonesia's 280 million people. Prabowo was billed as the continuity candidate to outgoing President Joko Jokowi Widodo, who must step down because of term limits, but he has bold ideas of his own. He is rolling out a $30 billion scheme for free meals in schools, plans to use technology like AI to fight endemic corruption, and wants to utilize new farming techniques to turn the world's fourth most populous nation into a food exporter within 5 years. Poverty, meanwhile, he vows to eradicate into. "Almighty God and the people of Indonesia gave me the mandate," he says. "I always say we need power, but to do good with that power." Yet Prabowo is a controversial figure, to put it mildly. He was one of the most feared generals under the reviled dictator Suharto, not to mention being the strongman's son-in-law. Serious human rights accusations meant he was banned from visiting the U.S. until his appointment as defense minister in 2019. He unsuccessfully ran for president twice with divisive campaigns that brazenly courted the Islamic right. But he finally triumphed by recasting himself as a jemoy, or cute, arid, cuddly grandpa, whose trademark dancing on the stump garnered so many millions of views on social media. Yet, activists fear that Prabowo's rise augurs an erosion of democracy and emboldening of military already accused of abuses in minority regions. As Southeast Asia's largest country and top economy, Indonesia has always been the linchpin of its strategically vital region. But with over a quarter of the world's supply of minerals, it has also emerged as a battleground between the U.S. and China for the copper, gold, and nickel, essential for the green transition and any new tech economy. Neither has a lock. Regular Chinese intrusions into Indonesia's territorial waters stoke public outrage, while Washington's support for Israel in the Gaza crisis has proved toxic in a nation with more Muslims than any other. Prabowo nods in all directions. His first foreign trip after his election was to see Chinese President Xi Jinping. In July, he also met Vladimir Putin in Moscow, describing Russia as a great friend. "We respect all great powers," Prabowo tells Time. "China is a great civilization, and the United States is a great power, but sometimes it makes mistakes. They forget who their true friends are. Some parts of the U.S. administration, at a certain point, have an opinion about that. But I always put the interest of my people first." Prabowo has been preparing to lead his entire life. In contrast with Jokowi, former carpenter raised in Ashanti and Indonesia's first leader without military or political connections, Prabowo is very much of elite stock. His grandfather founded Indonesia's central bank, while his father served as Minister for the Economy under the country's first president, Sukarno. But his father was forced into exile, so Prabowo spent his childhood in Singapore, Malaysia, Hong Kong, Switzerland, and England. Upon returning to Indonesia, Prabowo joined its Army and Special Forces Unit, Kopassus, and later received training in the U.S. Army's Fort Bragg and Fort Benning. His marriage to one of Sukarno's daughters kept him close to power as he climbed the military ziggurat. But after Suharto was toppled in 1998, Prabowo was stripped of his military command for alleged human rights violations and went into exile in Jordan. Upon returning home, he unsuccessfully ran for president in 2014 and 2019 before finally triumphing, thanks in large part to Jokowi's backing. It wasn't a natural unit. The two had been once rivals, and Prabowo's 2019 presidential run ended with thousands of his supporters converging on Jakarta to protest what they claimed was a stolen ballot. The results tallied with pre-election polls, and independent monitors found no malfeasance. 8 people were killed and over 600 injured as protesters armed with rocks and fireworks torched cars and battled police. Prabowo says he had an epiphany when faced with supporters nursing wounds and sputtering from caustic tear gas. "This young boy, no more than 17 or 18, looked at me and said, 'Prabowo, we are ready to die for you,'" he recalls. "I dropped to the side, shook him, and said, 'No, I don't want you to die for me. You must live for your parents and for Indonesia.' And then I just told myself, 'I'm not going to have these young kids die for me. I don't want that.'" It was a climb down that ultimately parked his ascent. After Prabowo ordered his followers home, Jokowi sent an emissary to seek talks. The two adversaries unexpectedly bonded, and Jokowi invited Prabowo into his administration. Although initially reluctant, Prabowo found the offer of leading his beloved armed forces impossible to turn down. "Jokowi is a very decent man," says Prabowo, adding with a grin, "and I would like to consider myself somewhat decent also." This softening belied Prabowo's formidable reputation as a battle-hardened Kopassus commando when the culture, as he puts it, was kill or be killed. But Prabowo is too complex a character to be distilled into simply the massacre general, as he sums up his Western reputation with a resigned eye roll. Along with the local Bahasa and Betawi dialects, he speaks fluent English, French, and German, over grilled ribeye and octopus salad at his favorite Italian restaurant in Jakarta, he's gregarious, musing about the importance of cartographers in the Napoleonic Wars, controversial links between race and intelligence in the 1994 treatise, The Bell Curve, and the role of religious sectarianism in the European Renaissance. He's currently devouring a biography of Catherine de Medici. "I'm an avid student of history," he says. Extremely health conscious, he rises at 6 a.m. to swim before beginning his day, listening to rock, classical, or military music on underwater headphones as aides linger nearby to note down any ideas that spring between lengths. He detests smoking, which can be problematic given almost three-quarters of male Indonesians light up, and has even scolded foreign dignitaries who indulge in the habit. Smokers on Prabowo's team are constantly trying to duck out for a quick puff without being noticed. He's obsessed by education and IQ, reeling off the supposed intelligence scores of historical figures. Einstein was 200. Napoleon was 180, he estimates. "I'm just 105. I'm not that smart, but I like to use smart people. I have a lot of 130 and 140 people working for me." Since part of Jokowi's team, Prabowo proved diligent and unswerving colleague. When the 2024 election arrived, Jokowi shunned the candidacy of his own party colleague to instead back Prabowo, who ran alongside Jokowi's eldest son, Gibran Raka, who will now serve as vice president. Yet many Indonesians are perturbed by Jokowi's attempts to retain influence. Besides Gibran, he has installed loyalists into the police and judiciary and defanged the nation's anti-corruption commission. Prabowo has no dynastic ambitions. His only son is an award-winning Paris fashion designer and scoffs at the idea that Jokowi's maneuverings portend conflict. The majority of the Indonesian people want continuity, Prabowo says. "The fact that Gibran is with me strengthens that bond." Prabowo insists that he's completely on the same page regarding Jokowi's signature downstream policy of processing raw materials locally to retain more of the value add. However, the fact that over 90% of Indonesia's nickel smelters, a key component of EV batteries, are built by Chinese companies has led to friction in the U.S. Last October, 9 U.S. senators signed a letter urging the Biden administration to reject a potential free trade agreement with Indonesia because of Chinese dominance of Indonesian mining and refining, among other concerns. Already, the 2022 Inflation Reduction Act stipulates that EVs containing China-sourced batteries and metal are ineligible for $7,500 tax rebates. Growing geopolitical headwinds have pushed Jakarta to diversify its investor pool for extra active industries. Prabowo insists that his goal is to keep Indonesia non-aligned, even if geopolitics renders this tightrope ever narrower. "We have the history of always being neutral," he says. When an Indonesian leader leaves this tradition, he brings us into disaster. "So we respect the Americans, but we also respect China." It was not always that way. Prabowo's military career was focused on countering leftist threats fostered by Beijing. Like many military men, he is hesitant to discuss his past campaigns, but eventually acquiesces over lunch in the defense ministry. Soon emerge tales of Prabowo standing in a minefield, one comrade's severed leg flying past his face, a suicide pact with another when cornered under heavy fire, and impersonating the noise of a buffalo to contact partisans deep in the Timorese jungle, only to be confronted by the real thing. While Prabowo insists he served with honor, accusations dog his various deployments. In Timor-Leste, where roughly 180,000 people perished during the 1975-1999 Indonesian occupation, he stands accused of overseeing the 1983 massacre of some 200 people in Karas, today dubbed the Town of Widows. In Timor-Leste's 2005 Truth and Reconciliation Report, Prabowo's name appears 19 times. Prabowo should be in jail, says Naldo Ray, a former child soldier for the Timorese resistance, who was imprisoned and tortured by the Indonesian military, not just for Timor-Leste, but also inside Indonesia. In August 1998, just months after the fall of Suharto's regime, at least 23 democracy activists were abducted. One was found killed, 9 were returned, and 13 others remain officially missing. Although Prabowo was never formally charged with any crime, a 2005 investigation by Indonesia's National Human Rights Commission attributed responsibility to Kopassus under the direct orders of its commander, Prabowo. He denies all allegations. "I've never caused any human rights abuses," he says. "My conscience is clear." He also points out that some former democracy activists detained under Suharto are now supporters, including one whom Prabowo has not entirely reassuring told during a campaign event, "Sorry, man, I used to chase you, but I've already apologized, right?" Still, it's unlikely that historical baggage will count against Prabowo in the international arena. We are all very happy that Prabowo is the president, Timor-Leste President Jose Ramos Horta tells Time in Dili, its capital. "With Prabowo, we may upgrade our relationship." There's little doubt that the cosmopolitan Prabowo will be more at home in the world than Jokowi, who tended to shun international forums like the UN. The question is whether Prabowo will finally rouse this sleeping giant from its slumber. "People always want Indonesia to be more active," Prabowo says, "but we have to take care of our people first." At Prabowo's ranch in the hills south of Jakarta, 400 young men in crew cuts and olive green uniforms fidget in an amphitheater as the Dutch war epic The East plays. Suddenly, the screen turns white and Prabowo strolls on stage, prompting all to stand and launch into a traditional Javanese war dance, punching the air, thumping chests, and enchanting in hypnotic unison. Prabowo strolls the ranks of recruits, asking their home provinces, their university majors, and razzing a couple of the stoutest about their paunch. These are recent university graduates from across Indonesia recruited for Prabowo's flagship project, dubbed Graduates for Development. The plan is to eventually recruit 500,000 smart young Indonesians, minimum IQ 110, into this special civil service program, instill them with military discipline and patriotic zeal, and dispatch them to far-flung provinces to guide development projects. Much as he did with his success in Mujara Angke, Prabowo wants to sidestep Indonesia's Kafkaesque bureaucracy with direct action. First duty, he says, will be the free school meals allowed by teaching farmers new sustainable agricultural techniques. I'm a man of action, Prabowo says later that evening over dinner in his ranch library, as he quietly passes scraps of meat to two of his favorite dogs, Kiki and Romeo, ensconced by his feet. I cannot see suffering, poverty, and injustice and not do anything. Following 10 years of Son of the Slums Jokowi, Prabowo represents a return to power for the nation's aristocracy, though today's informed, sophisticated Indonesians won't be satisfied with scraps from his table. Prabowo knows that his controversial background means judgment will be quicker and more withering. But after so many years in the wilderness, he is determined not to waste time. The success of society rests on the well-being of your people, he says, eyes suddenly narrowing. You are either with me or you can get out of the way. Folks, that does it for Time Magazine today. We are out of time, and I hope you've enjoyed hearing about what's happening. If you have missed any part of this broadcast or any of our other broadcasts, I invite you to go to sunsounds.org, click on Broadcast Info and Audio, and you will be able to stream any one of our programs. This is Peggy Garvey McMahon, your volunteer reader for Sunsounds. I've enjoyed reading for you today, and I'll look forward to next time. Have a great week. Bye now.